Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Toni Morrison. Morrison began her career as a textbook editor and then an editor at Random House, where she played a crucial role in the careers of numerous black writers. Beginning in 1970 with her novel The Bluest Eye, Morrison's career as a novelist formally began and has continued for over four decades and takes as its primary material the African-American experience. Her 1987 work, Beloved, earned Morrison a Pulitzer Prize for fiction and was made into an acclaimed film starring Oprah Winfrey and Danny Glover. In 1993, Morrison was awarded the Nobel Prize. Their citation says, Toni Morrison, who in novels characterized by visionary force and poetic import, gives life to an essential aspect of American reality. In 2012, President Barack Obama awarded Morrison the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Morrison spoke in Portland in 1992 as part of Portland Arts and Lectures. Here she is in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This is not my first trip to Portland, Oregon. I don't even think it's my second. I remember one trip here. It was with powerful memories, but there may have been an earlier one that I'm merging with another place. But it's always astonishing to remember how extremely beautiful this part of the country is. And I'm grateful to you for your warm welcome. This evening, I want to talk about two books and join them in a way in which I understand a kind of progression to have taken place in my work. To talk a little bit about Beloved and a little bit about a book forthcoming at the end of the month. And to suggest to you some of the obstacles that I created for myself in developing these books, and perhaps to talk and illustrate by very short examples in the books ways in which I approached the work. The embrace of history and fiction is what I was concerned with, or rather the effort to disentangle the grip of history while remaining in its palm, so to speak. Especially this particular piece of history and this particular novel. Now, I want us to agree for purposes of the rest of this talk that all of our education, whether it's in institutions or not, in homes and streets or wherever, whether it's scholarly or whether it's experiential, that there is a kind of a progression. We move from data to information, to knowledge, to wisdom. And separating one from the other, being able to distinguish among and between them, that is knowing the limitations and the danger of exercising one without the others, while respecting each category of intelligence, that is generally what serious education is about. And if we agree that purposeful progression exists, then you will see that at once how dispiriting this project of drawing or building or constructing fiction out of history can be, or that it's easy and it's seductive to assume that data is really knowledge, or that information is indeed wisdom, or that knowledge can exist without data, and how easy and how effortlessly one can parade and disguise itself as another, and how quickly we can forget that wisdom without knowledge, wisdom without any data, is just a hunch. And in writing Beloved, all of that became extremely acute because I resisted the data at my disposal and felt that I was quite fully informed I didn't have to know small things. I could invent them easily. I'd read all the same books you have about slavery, the historical books, the Slavery to Freedom and Roll Jordan Roll, and so Slavery and Social Death, and the Apthecker collections of documents, etc. I'd read Gutman's The Black Family, and then Slavery and Freedom, but particularly I had read the autobiographies of the slaves themselves, and therefore had firsthand information from people who were there. You add that to my own intuition, and you can see the shape of my confidence and the trap that it would lead me into, which would be confusing data with information and knowledge with hunches and so on. I thought I knew a great deal about it, and that arrogance was the first obstacle. What I needed was imagination to shore up the facts, the data, and not be overwhelmed by them. Imagination that personalized information, made it intimate, but didn't offer itself as a substitute. If imagination could be depended on for that, then there was the possibility of knowledge. Wisdom, of course, I would leave alone and rely on the readers to produce that. So here I am appropriating a historical life, Margaret Garner's life, from a newspaper article, which is sort of reliable and halfway unreliable, not doing any further research on her, but doing a lot of research around her, what things were like in 1853, 1855, and in the Reconstruction and so on in that part of the country, so that all of the details would be there. But realizing that the part of what is the imaginative process in dealing with history, coming from that original article, was this preacher who was interviewing her and telling her story with a great deal of shock, refused to make any judgments about her, withheld judgment, was sort of the way everybody was, although they all wrote these powerful editorials that were anti-fugitive slave law and so on. There was this sort of refusal to judge. And that little scrap of information seemed key to me, the inability to judge what this woman had done, the withdrawal from judgment, the refusal not to know, but to conclude. And there seemed just a little kernel of something in that. Why not judge her? Everybody else had. It was clearly terrible. That was a judgment. It was obviously unconscionable. It was harrowing what she had done. It was monstrous. But the interesting thing was, harrowing as it was, monstrous as it was, outrageous and inhuman as it was not illegal. It was everything but that. The law did not recognize the relationship, so there was no legal language to hold it. Margaret Garner wasn't tried for murder. She was tried for what the law could accommodate, what the law could judge, what the law deemed outlaw, which was the theft of property. The question for me then became, well, if the law is unwilling to judge, and her mother-in-law can't judge, who can? Who is in a position to condemn her absolutely for the thing the courts would not even admit susceptible to litigation? The accusing finger would have to have a lot of weight if it were to be a finger that Margaret Garner pays some attention to. And that would only be, of course, her daughter, the one she managed to kill. Successfully, if that term is applicable, before they stopped her. Well, I wasn't anxious to get or eager to get into those waters, but I thought, well, if she could do it, then I could sort of imagine it or think about it. and see what would happen when the dead daughter was introduced into the text. And of course, what it did do was it destabilized everything, reformulated its own history, and then changed language entirely. The other problem that is, in addition to the history, the actual outline or plot of Margaret Garner's life, and my alteration of it to suit my own purposes, is the in trying to do this is the problem of slavery. It would have been wonderful for me if she'd done this some other time, I suppose, like 10 years ago, and then I could deal with it, but it also happened in slavery. So the question is, how does one handle it or say it? How do you inhabit it? And all without surrendering to it, all without making it the major focus of the novel, rather than the slaves themselves. The problem is how to take the imaginative power, the artistic control, away from the institution of slavery and place it where it belongs, in the hands of the individuals who knew it, certainly as well as anybody, and that would be the slaves, and at the same time not to dismiss it or denigrate its horror. Because the problem is always pornography. It's very easy to write about something like that and find yourself in the position of a voyeur, where actually the violence, the grotesqueries and the pain and the suffering become its own excuse for reading. And there's a kind of relish in the observation of the suffering of another. I didn't want to go into that area, and it was difficult to find out, and difficult and important to find out where those lines were, where you stop, and how you can affect a kind of visceral and intellectual response without playing into the hands of surrender to the institution and making it its own excuse for being. I didn't want to chew on that evil and give it an authority that it didn't deserve, give it a glamour that it didn't really have, and to return the agency into the hands of the slaves who had always been fairly anonymous or flat, it seemed to me, in much, although not all, of the literature. Now, of course, here's 300 to 400 years to peruse, and it is indeed a humbling experience. You find that the sheer documentation, the history, is too long. It's too big, it's too awful, too researched, too ancient, too recent, too defended, it's too rationalized, it's too apologized for, it's too resisted, it's too known, and it's too unknown, and it's too passionate, and it's too elusive. And in order to explain other kinds of oppression, such as women's oppression, it was also very much appropriated. So I'm dealing in an area that I know is already overdone and underdone, attractive in an unhealthy sense, and repulsive, and hidden, and repressed in another. What I needed then to deal with what I thought was unmanageable was some little piece, some concrete thing, some image that came from the world of that which was concrete that would do it, something that was domestic, something that you could sort of hook the book onto, that would say everything you wanted to say in very human and personal terms about what that was. And for me, that image, that concrete thing, became the bit. Now, I had read references, seen these references to this thing people put in their mouths a lot, and noticed that because they were writing, the slave narratives were sort of very much like 19th century novels. There's certain things they didn't talk about too much. And also because they were writing for white people whom they wanted to persuade to be abolitionists or to do abolitionist type work, did not dwell, didn't spend a lot of time telling those people how terrible all this was. They didn't want to call anybody any names. They needed their money. So they sort of said, it was sort of an upbeat story. I was born, it was terrible, I got out, and other people are still there, and you should help them get out. They didn't stay and talk a great deal. There was a lot of hinting and a lot of reference, but nothing explicit that you could see. So that sometimes you see, oh, Equiano goes into a kitchen in New England and he sees a woman cooking and she has this thing in her mouth and he says, what is that? And somebody says, oh, that's a brake, B-R-A-K-E. And he said, I have never seen anything so awful in my life. And he leaves and doesn't talk about it anymore. And then I had seen all of these references, such as the following. I had some entries, very selective entries, from William Byrd in Virginia in the 18th century, early part of the 18th century, 1709, 1712. And his editors describe him, quote, as Virginia's most polished and ornamental gentleman, a kindly master who inveighed in some of his letters against brutes who mistreated their slaves. So what we did is just pull out all the references to violence that he could think of along with a lot of other stuff. So this is distorted in the sense of it's only about his occasions for this very gentle man, very well-spoken man, and one who believed that people should handle their slaves rightly. We just took out a couple of years of his own activities. February the 8th, Jenny and Eugene were whipped. April, Anna was whipped. May, Mrs. Byrd whips the nurse. May, Ma was whipped. June, Eugene, who was a little child, was whipped for running away and had the bit put on him. September, I beat Jenny. September, Jenny was whipped. September, I beat Anna. November, Eugene and Jenny were whipped. December, Eugene was whipped for doing nothing. Then the next year in July, the Negro woman ran away again with the bit on her mouth. July again, the Negro woman was found and tied, but ran away again in the night. 5 days later, my wife, against my will, caused little Jenny to be burned with a hot iron. Next month, I had a severe quarrel with little Jenny and beat her too much, for which I am sorry. Same month, Eugene and Jenny were beaten. October, I whipped three slave women. November, the Negro woman ran away again. And they're three or four more pages of that. And it is true that take it into consideration with other kinds of behavior, this was not all that bad. But the three references to the bit, none of which he explains or describes, were similar to many others we had read. And I had a lot of trouble trying to find descriptions of this contraption. Pictures. What did it look like? What did it do? And so on. And it was very, very difficult. I did end up being very lucky in a way. I found some pictures. But it was, I felt ultimately that it really wasn't something that really needed to be described. If I had described it exactly the way it was and found language to say exactly what those things looked like, it would have defeated my purpose. It was enough to know that you couldn't order them from a large warehouse, that you had to make them yourself. It was enough to know that these handmade things were not restrictive in the sense of they were not like docks where you couldn't work. You were supposed to go on and continue to work with this. It was important that it was not only used for slaves, it was used a lot for white women who sometimes, I suppose, needed or someone could feel that they needed the same sort of thing. Because a bit is just something that goes in your mouth. And it hurts, I suppose. It's inconvenient. But you know what it does? It's not that they're holding a bridle like a horse. It's just to keep you, make you shut up. You can't move your tongue. And for women, we know that would be a torture instrument. That would be primary. But it seemed that aside from these sort of masks that I saw, there were not really those bits with the tongue that goes in and out, and you sort of adjust it with a screw in the back. Not describing it technically, physically, became more important because I wanted it to remain indescribable, but not unknown. So the point began to render not what it looked like, but what it felt like and what it meant personally. Now that was the parallel of my attitude toward the history, toward the institution of slavery. That is, I didn't want to describe what it looked like, but what it felt like and what it meant. So I eliminated all the data from the Inquisition records that I read, Sao Paulo and Harper's Weekly and from Equiano and Slave Owners' Diaries, and tried to form language that would help me, and I hope the reader, to know it. Just know it. Nowhere in Beloved is this contraption described. But this is what I ended up with when I tried to make it completely known, or in the sense of how it felt and what it meant. At this point, this short little passage that I want to read, Sepha has found out that probably her husband never left that farm, Sweet Home, and that he probably saw what happened to her, because Paul D. thinks so. And she's angry when she hears it because she wants to know of Paul D. Why didn't he, if he saw her husband collapsed in this way, why he didn't help him? And why didn't he say something to him? Why did he just walk away without saying anything? And he said he couldn't because he had this thing in his mouth. And she sort of walks out. And anyway, eventually she asks him to tell her, not about what she's feeling about her husband, her ex-husband, but what that must have been like for him. He wants to tell me, he thought, she thought. He wants me to ask him about what it was like for him, about how offended the tongue is, held down by iron, how the need to spit is so deep, you cry for it. She already knew about it, had seen it time after time in the place before Sweet Home. Men, boys, little girls, women. The wildness that shot up into the eye the moment the lips were yanked back. Days after it was taken out, goose fat was rubbed in the corners of the mouth, but nothing to soothe the tongue or take the wildness out of the eye. Sepha looked up into Paul D's eyes to see if there was any trace left in them. People I saw as a child, she said, who'd had the bit, always looked wild after that. Whatever they used it on them for, it couldn't have worked because it put a wilderness, put a wildness where before there wasn't any. But when I look at you, I don't see it. There ain't no wildness in your eye, nowhere. There's a way to put it there, and there's a way to take it out. I know them both, and I haven't figured out yet which is worse. He sat down beside her. Sepha looked at him in that unlit daylight, his face, bronzed and reduced to its bones, smoothed her heart down. You want to tell me about it? She asked him. I don't know. I never have talked about it, not to a soul. Sang it sometimes, but I never told a soul. Well, go ahead. I can hear it. Maybe you can hear it. I just ain't sure I can say it. Say it right, I mean, because it wasn't the bit. That wasn't it. Well, what then? Setha asked. The roosters, he said. Walking past the roosters, looking at them, look at me. Setha smiled. In that pine? Yeah, Paldi smiled with her. Must have been 5 of them perched up there, and at least 50 hens. Mister, too? Not right off, but I hadn't took 20 steps before I seen him. He come down off the fence post there and sat on the tub. Oh, he loved that tub, said Setha, thinking, no, there is no stopping now. Didn't he? Like a throne. Was me took him out the shell, you know. He'd have died if it hadn't been for me. The hen had walked on off with all the hatched peeps trailing after her. There was this one egg left, looked like a blank. But then I saw it move, so I tapped it open, and here come Mister, bad feet and all. I watched that sausage grow up and whoop everything in the yard. He always was hateful, Setha said. Yeah, he was hateful, all right. Bloody, too, and evil. Crooked feet flapping, comb as big as my hand and some kind of red. He sat right there on the tub looking at me. I swear, he smiled. My head was full of what I'd seen of Hallie a while back. I wasn't even thinking about the bit. Just Hallie, and before him, 6-0. But when I saw Mister, I knew it was me, too. Not just them, me, too. One crazy, one sold, one missing, one burnt, and me licking iron with my hands crossed behind me, the last of the Sweet Home men. Mister, he looked so free, better than me, stronger and tougher. So he couldn't get out the shell by himself, but he was still king, and I was... Paldi stopped and squeezed his left hand with his right. He held it that way long enough for it and the world to quiet down and let him go on. Mister was allowed to be and stay what he was, but I wasn't allowed to be and stay what I was. Even if you cooked him, you'd be cooking a rooster named Mister. But was no way I'd ever be Paldi again, living or dead. School teacher changed me. I was something else. And that something was less than a chicken sitting in the sun on a tub. Setha put her hand on his knee and rubbed. Paldi had only begun. What he was telling her was only the beginning when her fingers on his knee, soft and reassuring, stopped him. Just as well, just as well. Saying more might push them both to a place they couldn't get back from. He would keep the rest where it belonged, in that tobacco tin buried in his chest where a red heart used to be. Its lid rusted shut. He would not pry it loose now in front of this sweet, sturdy woman, for if she got a whiff of its contents, it would shame him, and it would hurt her to know that there was no red heart, bright as Mistress Comb, beating in him.
You're listening to a talk by Toni Morrison. She spoke as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 1992. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and we'll be right back with more from Toni Morrison. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. Back to Toni Morrison now, speaking in Portland in 1992.
When I moved away from that project, which I thought was sort of incomplete, I began to think about another high point in American life that was also an extremely high point in African-American life that I wanted to write about. But this time it was, my problem was not, didn't seem to me to be how to deal with the history, but rather how to deal with the culture. There wasn't a great deal of history that had been written about the 20s, the period I call jazz, or we call jazz. There had been lots and lots of books, lots and lots of movies, lots and lots of images, lots and lots of everything. But there was still this huge, powerful, amorphous kind of understanding of what that culture was. And if I say the word jazz to anybody here, I'm sure something comes to mind, something very concrete, or maybe something that's unspecific. Maybe just the music, a certain kind of music. And if I pursue that image of jazz music, you know, a sample might surface, or a musician, or arrangement, or a song, or something. Or maybe just clubs, radio, you know, whatever comes to mind. And places where that particular kind of music we call jazz, or has been called jazz, is played. Or maybe just your own like of it, or your dislike of it, or your indifference to that particular music. But whatever you're thinking about that music, in the background of the word jazz, is the recollection, if not the main feature of your memory or your association, is that jazz is music black people play, or originated, or shaped, but that it's not exclusively played or even enjoyed by them now, or for even a long, long time. And also the fact that the appreciation of jazz is one of the few places where a certain kind of race transcendence or race transcendent embrace was possible, which doesn't mean there was no exploitation, but even the exploitation was possible only because of the interest in it and the passion for it and the embrace that did take place interracially, so to speak. The dictionary definitions of jazz list usually three or four entries relating to the music, where it originated in New Orleans around the beginning of the 20th century, and then they usually go on to talk, to characterize that music in very interesting words. Compulsive, for example, is used a lot. Intricate, freely improvised, and then they sometimes, at least the Webster's, charts the course of jazz from diatonism to chromaticism to atonality, and then they go on to list in some other entries in which jazz is not music, it's a kind of dance done to such music and having some of the characteristics of the music. But it's distinguished by violent bodily gestures and motions. And then following those definitions are slang definitions, including vigorous, liveliness, spirited, and insincerity, exaggeration, or pretentiousness. All that jazz. Don't give me all that jazz. You know, something that you don't have to pay any attention to because it's overstatement. But something that is jazzy is highly energetic and wildly active. But I don't think anybody really needs those dictionary definitions to clarify, because one of the attractions of the term is its loose association of energy and sensuality and freedom and release and intricacy, all that. All of it backgrounded by a recognizable music black people originated and shaped. All right, well, if you take music out of it, that may not be what one thinks of anyway when you're asked to complete the term jazz. I don't myself normally think of music first. But of the many images that might surface, one would be a sort of recent history period. The 20s, the period known as the jazz age. And attached to that term may be the sound of the music as it affected or backgrounded an era or generation of people whom we associate with that period. Jazz age elicits more detailed imagery. Prohibition, you know, a change in fashion that was alarming and sort of exciting in some places, short hair and skirts that in which women could actually walk and work and move. And and dance, these new dances. But it also suggested a kind of recklessness and license and sexuality. But if you've been the jazz age, the way I've just described it, to suit more literary interests, then we make the association with writers who reached their maturity or started out and did something wonderful or had some influence or fame during the 20s and early 30s. And we begin to think of that wonderful poetry and drama and the novels of a whole group of post-World War I American artists, Dos Passos and Fitzgerald and Hemingway and Stein and Pound. And, well, you know that list, and it's a familiar one. But familiar, too, is the whole constellation of things and people, the tone, the music, and the history that the word jazz evokes. And all of it is understood to be uniquely American. It's a uniquely American posture. And it suggests an American modernism that lingered on and on and on until there was something after modernism. And then, of course, something after that. And then something after that. But it is an American cultural phenomenon. And as such, it's more than any of the definitions or connotations that I've mentioned. It's really a concept. And it's interesting to me as a writer and for this book because it's so full of contradictions. It's American, indisputably American, and ethnically marginal. It's black and free. It's intricate and wild. It's spontaneous and practiced. It's exaggerated and simple. It's constantly invented, always brand new, but somehow familiar and known. Wherever you go in the world, if you say jazz, people say, oh yes, yes, I remember, or I understand, or I know. And I don't know if they're thinking about Josephine Baker or what, but they say, oh yes, yes, jazz, I know. It's immediately understood, and all explanations become redundant. Now, these contradictions have been very much on my mind because I was trying to think through some other concepts which had to do with this very, very important transition, I think, and transformation in the history of African Americans and very much a transformation in the history of this country. So my attempt then was to take not the history but the culture of jazz, which is much more, you know, ineffable and vaporous. And I wanted to demystify and revalorize the jazz idea, and to do that from a viewpoint that precedes its appropriation, you know, when it becomes anybody's and everybody's, and that reculturizes and deculturizes this idea. Now, it is a part, this view, looking at that period in black life, part of a rather sustained investigation I began with Beloved, which was a look, I'm really looking at self-regard in both racial and gender terms, and how that self-regard evolves or is distorted or flourishes or collapses, and under what circumstances. In Beloved, I was interested in what contributed most significantly to a slave woman's self-regard. What was her self-esteem? What value did she place on herself? And I became convinced, and research supported my hunch, my intuition, that it was her identity as a mother, her ability to be and to remain exactly what the institution says she was not, that was important to her. Moving into Reconstruction and beyond it, As difficult as it was to function as a mother with control over the destiny of one's children, it became then certainly a legal responsibility after slavery. So this is where the sources of self-regard came for Margaret Garner or Setha. And it is exaggerated because it's that important and that alien and that strange and that vital. But when Setha asks me, at the end of Beloved, it's a real movement toward a recognition of self-regard. But the answer to her question seemed to me to come or be available a generation or two later, when the possibility of personal freedom and interior imaginative freedom, not political or economic freedom, those were still distant, although there had been some changes, but this imaginative freedom could be engaged. So it seemed to me that while the history, the data of traditional historians both documented and denied this change in black life and in the culture, the information available to me in the cultural signs suggested there were alterations in the formulations and the sources of self-regard. Music, its lyrics, its performers held the first signs for me of this change in the culture. Movement, migration from rural areas to urban ones held other kinds of information. The literature, the language, the custom, the posture, all of this was what I would look at. And it seemed to me that the 20s, with its sort of nascent and overwhelming jazz idiom, was as distinct as it was because precisely of this change. That period, the jazz age, was a period when black people placed an indelible hand of agency on the cultural scene. And this agency, unremarked in economic and political terms, informs my project. And all the terms I cited earlier, defiance, violence, sensuality, freedom, intricacy, invention, and improvisation were intimated in the major figuration of that term: subjective, demanding, deeply personal love relationships. The one place African Americans could command and surrender by choice, where they did not marry who was chosen for them, or who lived down the road, or who was next door, where they could effect the widest possible choice by deciding to fall in love, claiming another as the beloved, not because of filial or blood relationships or proximity, but precisely because it was ad hoc and accidental and fated but not predictable. And this assertiveness, this creative agency, seemed to me most clear in the music, the style, the language of that post-Reconstruction era that represented both transition and transformation. You know, like life lived in flour sacking or plain dull cotton gives you a hunger, a desperation for color and patterns and powerful primary colors. In the same way that hundreds of years of being mated off or ordered whom to marry, of needing permission to join with another, of having to take these extraordinary, drastic measures to keep a family together and to behave like a family. And all of this under the greatest stress, with so little evidence that anything would ever change. You could get slaves to do anything at all, bear anything, if you gave them any hope that they could keep their children. They'd do anything. Every impulse, every gesture, everything they did was to maintain their families. Well, under those historical pressures, then the desire for choice in partners, the desire for romantic love, operate as a place, a space, a way for individual reclamation of the self. That is a part, maybe the largest part, certainly an important part, of the reconstruction of identity. Part of the me, so tentatively articulated and beloved, that's what she needs to discover. It would account for the satisfaction in the blues lyric and the blues phrase, whether or not, and mostly not, the relationship flourishes. They're usually, you know, somebody's gone and not coming back, or some terrible thing has happened, never see this person again. Whether or not the affection is returned, whether or not the loved one reciprocated the ardor, the lover, the singer, has achieved something, accomplished something in the act of being in love. It's impossible to hear that sort of blues cry without acknowledging in it the defiance, the grandeur, the agency that frequently belies the wail of disappointed love. And it may be through that agency and the even more powerful assertiveness of what we call jazz, which uses those gestures, that is how compromise becomes reconciliation. It's also the way in which imagination fosters real possibilities. If you can't imagine it, you can't have it. And a third thing grows where despair may have been, or even where the past lay hold and wouldn't let go. And it is this third thing that jazz creates, and that creates itself in these spaces and intersections of race and gender that interest me, and which informed and propelled the writing of this book called Jazz. I want to read just a page or two, which is not, what is a kind of an illustration of that gesture of choice and love. It's nice when grown people whisper to each other under the covers. Their ecstasy is more leaf sigh than bray, and the body is the vehicle, not the point. They reach way down underneath tissue. They are remembering while they whisper the carnival dolls they won and the Baltimore boats they never sailed on. The pears they let hang on the limb, because if they plucked them, they would be gone from there, and who else would see that ripeness if they took it away for themselves? How could anybody passing by see them and imagine for themselves what that flavor would be like? Breathing and murmuring under covers both of them have washed and hung out on the line, in a bed they chose together and kept together. Never mind one leg was propped on a 1916 dictionary, and the mattress curved like a preacher's palm asking for witnesses in his name's sake, enclosed them each and every night and muffled their whispering old-time love. They are under the covers because they don't have to look at themselves anymore. There is no stud's eye, no chippy glance to undo them. They're inward toward the other, bound and joined by carnival dolls and the steamers that sail from ports they never saw. That is what is beneath their undercover whispers. But there's another part, not so secret, the part that touches fingers when one passes the cup and saucer to the other, the part that closes her neckline, snap, while waiting for the trolley, and brushes lint from his blue serge suit when they come out of the movie house and into the sunlight. I envy them their public love. I myself have only known it in secret, shared it in secret, and longed all along to show it, to be able to say out loud what they have no need to say at all, that I have loved only you, surrendered my whole self reckless to you and nobody else, that I want you to love me back and show it to me, that I love the way you hold me, how close you let me be to you. I like your fingers on and on, lifting, turning. I've watched your face for a long time now and missed your eyes when you went away from me. Talking to you and hearing you answer, that's the kick. But I can't say that aloud. I can't tell anyone that I've been waiting for this all my life, and that being chosen to wait is the reason I can. If I were able, I'd say it. Say, make me. Remake me. You're free to do it, and I'm free to let you. Because look, look, look where your hands are. Now. Thank you.
That was Nobel Prize winning writer Toni Morrison. She spoke in Portland in 1992. Morrison is the author of The Bluest Eye and Beloved, and earned the literary world's most prestigious prizes over her long career, including the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and the Nobel Prize, as well as the Presidential Medal of Freedom. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for The Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any of the other talks in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces The Archive Project for radio. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.